This is the Financial Sense News Hour. Now, here's the Financial Sense News Team, Jim Poplava and John Loeffler.
Well, here we are. Well, first of all, we're back into the Financial Sense News Hour and starting what we call the big picture, where we try to interpret events for you so that you actually understand what is happening, because many times the media are generally not informing you. They are ignoring things by ignorance, bias, or neglect, or being journalist activists. And boy, has the journalism activism really come pouring through in this last election. Any semblance of impartiality or actually reporting the news, that cover has been pretty well blown. But we are in silly season because people are saying silly things. Most of the political coverage is concentrated on the trivia and the irrelevant. Donald Trump said this and Hillary Clinton said that. And it's all about little stuff or things that, well, maybe it's an issue, but it really isn't going to be the big issue that we are going to face, issue or issues. We would hope that there would be more serious discussion on the part of our candidates about the Middle East, the war on terror, the fact that we have an awful deficit and a blooming debt. The economy is wobbly, and why a large number of people on both the left and the right are headed in the wrong direction. Instead, they're trying to achieve political outcomes by spatting over every little thing that these two candidates say, depending on which media outlet you are watching. Most of this, however, has little effect and little relevance on the issues that are going to confront the next president. Remember last election, the media focused on the fact that Governor Romney was a rich person, therefore he couldn't identify with the poor. But notice this time, you're not hearing anything. Obviously, Donald Trump is a billionaire, but the Clintons themselves are worth $150 million, and media are quiet because it's not in their advantage right now. So can we ever get beyond the silly? Yes, the answer to that question is they may not, but we're going to do it. We need to talk about the things that will confront this next president, not to mention a series of crises which seem to be coming over the horizon. We have a national debt that the day the new president takes office will be right around $20 trillion. What about derivatives and the danger to the financial system? The rich, we keep hearing, need to pay their fair share of taxes, but by the government's own figures, they already do. The economy is in major trouble, and I don't hear any proposals for fixing it, and geopolitical risk in a whole series of areas is actually rising. So, Jim, we are not running for president, but we're going to cover those issues that the presidential candidates should be covering.
You know, it's amazing, John, how the election cycle has changed, because when George Bush left office, one of the big political debates in the 2008 presidential election was the national debt, because under George W., he had doubled the national debt from $5 trillion to $10 trillion. And now, as you pointed out, the next president, whoever that may be, he or she, the debt will be at $20 trillion. And on top of that, the deficit is starting to rise. It got down into the low $400 billion range. Now it's approaching close to $600 billion. And we're going to talk in this segment on why that debt is actually understated. It's probably $200 billion larger than that, because they're not counting all the interest that is paid on the debt, the interest that's paid publicly, and the interest that is not paid publicly, for example, debt held by the Social Security Trust Fund. So here's the fact. When the next president takes office, which will be January 20th of next year, he or she is going to inherit a deficit of $20 trillion. Now, as we pointed out, each president, beginning with Bush and then Obama, has doubled. Here's the scary fact. $10 trillion is a lot of money. It was a lot of money when George Bush left office with the national debt at $10 trillion. But you realize, John, in one administration, President Obama has added more debt than all of his predecessors combined. And what that means is the national debt is growing at an exponential rate now. And that is something, John, have you heard that brought up anywhere in the debates? I don't remember much of that brought up, even in the Republican debates when we had 17 candidates. I think Rand Paul might have addressed the issue, but very few people have talked about the national debt or the size of the deficit.
Well, no, they haven't. But again, as I've said, you know, the politics is a blood sport. That's one thing that people need to understand. The goal is to win, to get the football over the goal line. The last time we really saw that in large mass was the whole debate over Obamacare, the Affordable Health Care Act, when we had no idea what was in it. When people tried to raise it, they were ridiculed and made fun of. And finally, House Speaker Nancy Pelosi said we had to pass the bill to find out what's in it. Now, that's just backwards of what we're supposed to be doing. And now that we have found out what's in it, we don't like it. And all of that is unraveling as we watch it. But the goal here is the blood sport of getting the football over the goal line. And that's what these media are oriented to doing. Facts, not important. Let's get on with the blood sport.
Well, let me add some other facts. And this is why the media says, you know, they're not talking about it, because they go, look, you know, it's grown. But, you know, the good thing is interest rates have come down. It's cheaper to finance. And that's absolutely true. This number I'm going to give you is absolutely staggering. In 2008, the interest on the debt, and when I say the interest on the debt, it doesn't include everything. In 2008, the government spent $451 billion on interest. And in 2008, at the end of that year, the national debt was $10.025 trillion. Fast forward to 2015, the government's fiscal year, in September. So in 2015, the national debt was $18.150 trillion. That was September of 2015. So in that period, the national debt went up by $8.126 trillion. Now, here's the fascinating thing. During that same period of time, the debt increased by $8 trillion. Interest expense for the government went down by $49 billion a year. Total interest on the debt was $402 billion last year. So this is a good example of something that we've been talking on this program, which is financial repression, which is bringing down the level of interest so debt can expand and be paid for. For example, to go back to 2008, where, you know, the government at that time was paying an average rate of close to 4% on the national debt, today, that figure has been cut nearly in half. And you're going to find this fascinating, because we have two kinds of debt that the government counts. There's called marketable debt. That is the debt that you and I can go out in the marketplace. If you want to buy a T-bill, a treasury note, or a treasury bond, or let's say invest in a mutual fund that invests in government debt, that's the public debt. That's what you and I have the ability to make an investment in. There's what is called non-marketable debt, and this is debt that is held in trust funds, like Social Security and various other funds, because what the government does is during the years that Social Security was generating a surplus, which it is not doing now, the surplus would be spent, and then what Congress would do would just issue an IOU, and it would go into a special fund or a file. It was basically a cookie jar with IOUs. Now, the non-marketable debt, the interest rate on that debt is, I'm going to round it off, 2.8%. The marketable debt, and that's all the securities that the U.S. government has publicly traded, everything from treasury bills to treasury notes to treasury bonds. The interest on that marketable debt is 2.02. So basically call it 2%. Now, if you add the interest together, both marketable debt and non-marketable debt, the interest that the government pays on its debt is 2.25%. That is down from almost 2.35% last year. Now, why that becomes significant is what happens when interest rates start to rise. If the Fed raises short-term interest rates, whether it's treasury bills, they start to rise. That means it costs the government more to finance its debt. And we'll get to that in a minute. Now, one of the things that you have heard in this debate is you have two different kinds of views of how to stimulate the economy. Both parties, the Republican Party and the Democratic Party, are talking about we need to do something to fix this economy and get it moving in the right direction, because public opinion polls say that 70% of Americans feel overall the economy has been heading in the wrong direction.
Well, given all of this debt, and this is what's really funny, because nobody's mentioning this right now. I think, like you say, I can't remember if Senator Rand Paul did. Remember, his father did during the previous debates, Congressman Ron Paul. But what we're hearing is that we're going to have free college, we're going to build a wall, we're going to have expanded Medicare, we're going to make Social Security more enticing. It's free, 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 but there's not much indication as to how we're going to pay for it other than we'll tax the rich. Or how about a little percentage tax on all transactions on Wall Street?
Now, the reason this is kind of interesting, John, if we take the government's budget, its financial report from its fiscal year 2015, last year, the government spent $3,859 billion. Now, here's what is important. Of that, let's round it off, $3.9 trillion, $1,974 billion was on Medicare, Medicaid, and Social Security. That's 51% of the budget deficit. Furthermore, when the government reports its financial statements, last year, the government reported that interest on the national debt was $251 billion. Now, the real figure was $402 billion, because that's the amount that is credited or owed on the amount of securities, treasuries, that are owned by all of these trust funds, from Social Security to Medicare to Medicaid to the Disability Trust Fund. So the budget deficit last year, which got down to somewhere in the low $400 billion range, was understated by $150 billion. And this is the thing you have to be careful with government accounting, because the real numbers are often obfuscated for the general public. So you can say, gosh, I drove the deficit down to $400 billion from $1.4 trillion, which is, you know, Obama's first year in office, the deficit was $1.4 trillion. And now everybody's, you know, sort of gloating and say, look, we've got it down to 400. Well, this year it's going to be closer to 600 billion. And if you add the interest that isn't reported on the government's fiscal statement, the true deficit this year will be about $750 billion. Now, that's a number, John. Do you hear anybody talking about that?
No. I mean, well, what am I going to say? No, you don't hear that.
Yeah. And here's why this becomes significant. Right now, as I pointed out, total interest, or the interest rate that government pays on all of its debt, that's treasury bills, everything from 3-month T-bills to 30-year treasury bonds, that interest rate is 2.25%. Well, beginning in January, the U.S. government deficit will be $20 trillion. Now, if interest rates go up, like they did, you know, maybe they don't get as high as they were in 2008. Maybe they only get somewhere in between them, because around 2008, we were at roughly 4.5% to 5% interest rates. But let's say the interest rate goes up 1%. What that means is the government will have to spend an additional $200 billion in interest. If interest rates go up 2%, the government will have to spend, then, in other words, the interest it's paying now will actually double. It will go from $400 billion to $800 billion, and we'll be approaching nearly $1 trillion, basically 25% of government expenditures will be allocated to the national debt. So, I mean, this is something that nobody's talking about. In the last 8 years, the deficit has grown at 8.85%. So let's just round it off and say the debt is growing at 9% a year. Where this becomes a problem is GDP growth is growing at only 2% a year. So the national debt is growing at almost 4 times the rate of economic growth. And we know, John, I don't care if you're looking at Venezuela, you're looking at Argentina, you're looking at Russia's debt default, you cannot grow your debt at 4 times the rate of what you're growing the economy. Another way of saying that, it is taking almost $4 of debt to get a dollar of economic growth today. And that is basically unsustainable. You cannot keep going in this direction.
Yeah, but you have to grapple with the unreality of the situation, because the media avoid these numbers in discussing them. So do the candidates. If they are, we're not hearing about it. About the need to lower Medicare, we're hearing. increase in Social Security benefits, making it more generous, and free college. But what goes unmentioned, Jim, is what you're telling us is we can't afford it.
No, we not only can't afford it, but John, unlike the election of 2008, where the deficit and the debt was a major issue in the political campaign because it was favorable to the media's bias in terms to talk about it. Because, you know, everybody blamed George Bush for doubling the national debt from $5 trillion where it was when he took office to $10 trillion where it was when he left office. And everybody was talking about the economy, a topic we'll get to shortly. So, and here's the problem. Not only do we not have the money, what the media kept out of the front pages was last November, there was a budget deal that was done in Congress. And the budget deal was done behind closed doors. Nobody talked about it. But the Disability Trust Fund would be bankrupt in 2016. And that was a problem because disability has almost gone up 40% under President Obama because he lowered the standards. There was no money left. So what they did is they did a backroom deal on Social Security. They got rid of file and suspend and file and restrict, which would be more favorable for women as Social Security recipients. But what they essentially did is they bought themselves time. They bought themselves a little over a year so they can get to 2017 and pass the election. And what they did is they funded the Disability Trust Fund by basically taking money out of the Social Security Trust Fund. And this is what our politicals do all the time. You know, you never heard, I think maybe during the Republican debate, John, I heard two or three of the candidates talk about there is no trust fund. It's basically a drawer with IOUs in it. It's money that's been borrowed and spent by the government. And so you don't hear any mention of the government talking about disability or that backroom deal that shortchanged women in Social Security. So that is discussed nowhere. But they're talking about making actually more benefits. And it's just, gosh, if we could just make those terrible rich people pay more fair share in taxes, we can have these things. So we're really moving ourselves in a direction and on the road to a debt and fiscal crisis. As I pointed out over and over, right now, Social Security and Medicare represent over 50% of the government's budget. By 2025, in the next 10 years, that will represent 100% of the government's budget. Now, if the debt continues on the growth rate that it is right now, growing at 9%, by the year 2025, our national debt will be $47 trillion. Folks, you cannot grow your debt at 4.5 times the rate of economic growth. So somewhere down the road between this year and the year 25, we're going to run into a fiscal and debt crisis in this country because this is absolutely unsustainable. It's kind of like going back to the financial crisis of the last decade where Wall Street was pushing these junk mortgages and consumers were just heavily laden with debt and they were just piling it on with the idea that interest rates would remain low and that they would be able to afford making their debt payments. And then we know what happened. We had a financial crisis where the government had to come out, bail out our financial institutions. A lot of homeowners defaulted on their mortgages. And we were in a major financial crisis, probably the biggest crisis the country faced since the Great Depression. We're moving in that general direction again, and this time it's going to be worse because at least in the 2008 crisis, the Fed leveraged its balance sheet, grew it by over $4 trillion. They backstopped over $9 trillion. They backstopped money market funds, the commercial paper market. They bailed out banks from AIG, and the government stepped into the fray and made up the difference by leveraging itself. And as a result, we had to raise taxes. But John, the next crisis is going to be so large. What is the government going to do 3 years, 4 years, or 5 years from now when there simply isn't enough money to pay the interest on the debt? And eventually the bond market will force interest rates up. And I think it was James Carville said, if I ever was to be reborn again, I'd come back as a bond trader because then I could intimidate governments. And at some point in time, the bond market is going to wake up to this fact as it did in the late 70s, and it will force interest rates higher. And those rates, as they go up, the government simply will not have the money to make its debt payments. And that's why we are heading for a debt and fiscal crisis in the next decade.
you know, we've talked about this before. What then is a country to do? Are we going to default on this, pay it back? What's the way off?
Well, there's four ways that countries get rid of debt. One is to grow your way out of it. And if you look at both candidates, they're saying, you know what, the economy's growing at 2%. It's more likely 1% now. At least that's what it was in the first half of the year. We're going to create policies that make for stronger economic growth. The problem is you've got debt growing at four times the economic growth rate. So let's say whoever the candidate is, Clinton or Trump, they come in and they double the economic growth to 4%. Well, if you're growing at 4% and your debt is growing at 9%, you still have a problem. So throw out the first option, which is to grow your way out of it. The second way you get rid of debt is basically to default, which is what Greece, Argentina, Russia, Turkey, and other countries have done over the years. Unlikely to happen for a major currency like the U.S. and the U.S. economy. The third thing you could do is pay it back. Well, there's just no way, folks, that we have the money or the tax revenues to pay back the debt. It's gotten too large. It's grown too fast. And once interest rates start to rise, it'll become unsustainable. So that leaves option number four, which is to inflate or devalue your way out of it. And just like President Nixon did in August of 1971, you wake up one morning and Nixon basically devalued the U.S. dollar and taking it off gold backing. So overnight, you can see a country devalue its currency and essentially shed all its debt. They can devalue it by 50%, 75%, depending on how bad the debt crisis is. And essentially, you just inflate the heck out of your debt. And that is one way you can get out of it, which is one way Roosevelt stopped deflation in 1933. So we're heading towards the path of inflating and devaluing the currency because it's the only way out at this point. There's no way we can grow our way out. There's no way we can pay it back. We're unlikely to default. So what you do is what many governments do, and especially large governments, is you devalue. So the long and short of it, John, somewhere down the road between now and 10 years from now, and I don't think it'll be 10 years, I think it'll be in the next four-year election cycle for the next president, we are going to be facing a fiscal crisis of unimaginable levels because we're not doing things that are appropriate that would help the economy. We're actually going in the opposite direction.
Well, you know, now they're finally talking about infrastructure use of money to provide stimulus, I guess, which is what the Obama administration should have done, but did not do. But okay, we're going to pour this money in, and yeah, we have some assets to show for it, theoretically, in infrastructure. Is that a good idea?
Well, I mean, if you're going to do anything right now, because the U.S. infrastructure in this country is crumbling, the U.S. Society of Engineers gives the U.S. a D-. And that's a major problem. Now, if the government was to go out and spend money and rebuild the infrastructure, the highway system, our airports, our roads, bridges, our utility structure, all of that would make the economy more productive. And that would enhance economic growth. So if you were going to spend money, that would be the way to deficit spend. And more importantly, with interest rates at historical lows, if you could finance that infrastructure with 30-year bonds at 2.25%, that would actually make financial sense. And so that would actually be positive for the economy. But once again, you'd be growing the debt. But if you did things that made the economy more productive and made it more efficient, then that would actually be a good thing to do. But that's not what we do. When you put all of your money into transfer payments through entitlements, what you do is you give somebody a check. They go out and spend the check. What do you have to show for it? You have nothing to show for it. If you expand and you do infrastructure, well, you can say, look, we have a new bridge. We have a more modern rail system. We have more modern airports. We have more modern waterways. Those kind of things you would have something to show for would make the economy much better off and help the economy grow. But when you do it all in transfer payments by giving people free stuff, once they spend it, you have nothing to show for it. So, you know, depending on how it is structured, debt for just debt's sake and transfer payments is actually making the situation even more worse.
Let's move on to our next topic that we think people should be discussing during the presidential race here. That would be derivatives. And this bugaboo comes up periodically as being a tremendously threatening dragon, but then it seems to go underground again. Now, a lot of investors are skittish about the market. They've been through two bear markets. We had the tech bubble burst, the housing bubble burst, as a result of what happened in 2007 and 2008. I mean, we've seen things in financial institutions and bailouts to bring the system up that we've never seen before. And where we are now, some people are feeling things are back on the right track. As you've said, look at what happened. We had the Brexit vote. The market buckled for a day or two and then got back to humming along quite nicely. But in reality, we're facing grave problems. Let's look at the area of derivatives, because that has the potential to come out of left field where nobody's watching it. And one day nobody's even thinking about it. The next day it's headlines.
Yeah, and that's what happens in these kind of markets. And the only time it garners, let's say, media attention is when something happens, like when long-term capital management went under and had to be bailed out by a consortium of Wall Street banks. And then, of course, you know, before that, it was the S&L crisis in 1991. Then, of course, the financial crisis of 2007 and 2009, where, for example, AIG was writing all these credit default swaps, and it took the government, it cost us taxpayers nearly $200 billion to bail out because AIG didn't have the capital to stand behind the credit default swaps it had written. And here's something that has happened as a result of the financial crisis. Too big to fail got even bigger. I don't care if you're looking at JP Morgan, Citigroup, Bank of America, or Goldman Sachs. They're much bigger today than they were back in 2008. Now, here's the scary part. And we updated these figures. They're as of the end of 2015. JP Morgan has assets of $2.352 billion. So let's round that off to say $2.4 trillion of assets, a very giant bank. It has equity, that means actual shareholder capital, to back up those assets for losses, if, let's say, bad loans are made, of $248 billion. So you might say, wow, almost $250 billion. They've got a lot of equity. And there's a lot of pundits that have talked about, well, the U.S. banking system has gotten itself into good shape. Here's the problem. J.P. Morgan has roughly $66 trillion. The actual number is $65,776,000,000 in derivatives. Now, what backs up those derivatives if those trades go wrong? And J.P. Morgan has to stand up on those derivatives like they did in the London Whale, where they lost $6 billion. Well, any losses are made up from that equity of $248 billion. Well, if you take their derivatives to their equity, J.P. Morgan is leveraged 265-1. Go down the list. You go down to Citigroup. Citigroup has assets of $1.7 trillion. They have equity of roughly about $222 billion. They have a derivative book of $47 trillion. Citigroup is leveraged 212-1. You go to Bank of America. They have assets over a little over $2.1 trillion. They have $256 billion of equity. They have a derivative book of $26.4 trillion. They're leveraged 103-1. Then you take Goldman Sachs. Goldman Sachs has assets of $861 billion. They have equity of $87 billion. They have a derivative book of $39 trillion. Goldman Sachs is leveraged roughly about 450-1. Now, if you take a look at this, and, you know, a lot of people are saying, well, you know, things have gotten better. Assets have grown. The equity of the banks have grown as they've added profits. So they've got the profits builds up the equity of the firm. And derivatives have been growing at a slower rate than what equity and assets are. So you could say, well, that's very positive. The problem with derivatives is the bulk of the world's derivatives are in the handful of very large players who have gotten much larger since 2008. Gross derivatives globally today are $650 trillion, 5 to 6 times, maybe 8 times larger than global GDP. And the real danger out there is Deutsche Bank, which has had loose financial controls to the concern of even the Fed. And there's been a lot of talk about what's going on with the European banking system, and especially Deutsche Bank. Now, the problem with derivatives is most of these derivative trades are done with each other. So Goldman's doing deals with JP Morgan, Citigroup, Bank of America. They're all doing these deals back and forth. And the problem is if one of those banks gets in trouble like AIG did with its credit default swaps, all of a sudden you have a daisy chain domino effect throughout the financial system, very much in terms of what we saw happen in the fall of 2008.
I'm glad you brought this up because something I wanted to mention here was the subject of too big to fail. You know, we've always heard that expression that there's a justification why the Fed or the government has to step in to bail something out, because if it were to fail, it would affect many, many people. Dodd-Frank theoretically was supposed to prevent that. But I think this is something bigger than that, that they don't really have a control on.
They really don't understand it. I mean, even the investment banks management up at the top. I mean, you know, it was very embarrassing for JP Morgan in the London whale trade. They lost $6 billion. Now, guys on the trade desk may be understanding this, but the guys at the top, I mean, do you really understand the complexity of these trades? And the problem is it's all concentrated in a handful of players. Now, the proponents of derivatives have fought off through lobbyists. They fought off basically the legislators. And that's one of the problems that we have in this election. Wall Street is a major player. I think they've donated, about close to $50 million to the Clinton campaign, because not only do they enjoy favorable tax rates, but they don't want this stuff regulated because it's very profitable for these banks. And the proponents of derivatives would argue, yeah, but when you take that number and you do what is called a net derivative exposure, it's only roughly about $21 trillion, like $21 trillion was insignificant. And that's why they've been arguing, well, gosh, you know, the number is really big, but when you really get it down to the net position, it's really not that big. It's about a little bigger than the U.S. economy.
Yeah, I'm guessing you probably don't buy that.
No. And let me give you an example of why I don't do that. The real problem here is the gross exposure. And let me give you an example from the futures market. When you buy a futures contract, let's say you buy a contract for gold or the S&P, you buy a $1,000 contract. You put 10% down. So on that $1,000 contract, you only have 10% in the contract. So it doesn't take much for the movement in that commodity to wipe out your equity. And that's a problem that you have with derivatives. So let me give an example. Let's suppose, for example, I've taken a position that I am long interest rates. In other words, I think interest rates are going to go down. I've got a long position of $100 million. Now, given the change in constant rhetoric coming from the Fed, I'm not quite sure if I want that long position. So let's say I'm going to hedge it and I'm going to go short by $80 million. So I'm looking at my long position of $100 million. I've got a hedge against it of $80 million on a short position. So the net is only $20 million. Here's the problem. That short position of $80 million is only as good as the people I've got the contract with and their ability to deliver in case the market goes in an adverse situation. So I'm thinking, gosh, I've protected myself with my short position, but my short position is only as good as that counterparty's ability to deliver on that short position. And that was one of the problems that we ran into in the financial crisis. And it reminds me of something that Jim Rickards wrote about in his new book. I'm quoting him here, and he goes, "In complex systems, shorts are not subtracted from longs. They are added together. Every dollar of notional value represents some linkage between agents in the system. Every dollar of notional value creates some interdependence." Here's the key. If a counterparty fails, what started out as a net position for a particular bank instantaneously becomes a gross position because the hedge has disappeared. Fundamentally, the risk is in the gross position, not the net. In other words, total gross credit exposure or gross market value are relevant when it doesn't matter when markets are functioning normally. So this net-net position, if we were in a normal market, as we have been most of the time when we're not in a financial crisis, this may be irrelevant. But here's the thing. In a crisis, as Mr. Rickards explains, counterparties either will be unable and or unwilling to perform in the volume of broken contracts will overwhelm these institutions and render them instantaneously insolvent. And that is the problem with these derivative contracts. They're illiquid, they're large, they're leveraged, and in a real financial crisis like we got in 2008, what happened is the counterparties couldn't deliver. They couldn't pay up. Lehman couldn't pay. You know, Merrill couldn't pay. A lot of these companies went under. AIG couldn't pay. The government had to back them up. And that's when this becomes relevant. So this is a ticking time bomb. And the thing that makes it more serious is 90% of these contracts are credit and interest rate related. Now, think about this. We are experiencing the lowest interest rates in recorded human history. Never before have we actually had negative rates. So are you going to tell me that $650 billion, of which 90% is credit and interest rate related, if interest rates start to move in the opposite direction, that we're not going to have a problem there with all these bets that have been made? How will they be unwound? Can they be unwound? Will there be liquidity in the market to do so? And that's what we see over and over again when these things happen. That's when the market dries up and counterparty risk rises to the top. And that's where you get this daisy chain of defaults with dominoes one after another, as pretty much what we saw between 2008 and 2009. So here's something, John, they're not talking about. Everybody thinks, well, gosh, we fixed the financial system. Folks, no, we didn't.
Well, let's move on to the next topic. The one I always like here is, it depends on how you define fair. The rich need to pay their fair share. And the thing we're being given is, if you've got all these little loopholes, most of the rich skip out on it. They cite one or two examples. Of course, a lot of times they fail to mention, Jim, a lot of the so-called rich people in the categories they're looking at are moms and pops who own farms and ranches and businesses and whatever, because the word millionaire doesn't mean much anymore in terms of today's values.
No, it doesn't. And this is from Treasury and IRS reports of who pays the taxes. And the government has various definitions of who's rich. The top 1%, the government defines as anyone that's making over $430,000 a year. If you make $430,000 or more a year between you and your wife or a couple or an individual, you are considered in the top 1% of the country. That top 1% that makes over $429,000 paid 38% of the entire nation's income tax bill. Let's move down to the next category, which is the top 5%. The government defines the top 5% as any couple making $180,000 a year. If we take the top 5% of this country, those making $180,000 a year or more, the top 5% pay roughly 59% of the nation's income taxes. Now let's move down the scale and take the top 10%. The top 10% is anybody making over $128,000. The top 10% in this country, individuals making over $128,000, pay roughly 70% of the nation's income taxes. Now let's go to the top 25%, which is anybody that's making $75,000 a year. The top 25% pay 86% of the nation's income taxes. And then finally, they rounded off at the top 50%. It's anybody making over $37,000 a year. You pay 97% of the nation's income taxes. But I found it amazing that the rich aren't paying their fair share. Well, the top 1% pay roughly 38% of the country's taxes. The top 5% pay nearly 60% of the nation's taxes. So the idea that there's just a whole bunch of rich people out there, gosh, if we could just tax them more and more, we'll have the money to spend on anything that we want, simply doesn't hold up.
Yeah, but it sure sells in political platforms.
Well, I mean, every election, the allegations are about taxes. The rich aren't paying their fair share. They're getting away with murder, and tax cuts benefit the rich. Well, you know what? The argument is you got to pay taxes to get a tax cut. If 50% of the country doesn't pay income taxes, a tax cut doesn't benefit it. They're absolutely right. If you make below $37,000, you're probably not paying any income taxes, so a tax cut is probably not going to help you out. Now, if you're making $37,000 and you're single and you don't have any deductions, you are paying some income tax. And here's another factor they don't tell. From 1986 to the present, the share of taxes that the richest Americans pay, that's everybody above 37, has grown from 93% to over 97%. And the lowest 50%, the amount of taxes they pay, were cut in half. And so this nonsense about the rich aren't paying taxes is just silly. Well, it's disingenuous more than anything else. And what was it? Gosh, there was somebody that came up with a spoof on this. John, you may know who it was, where they said, let's just take the rich people. Let's just say, you know, we're going to take away all of Warren Buffett's money. We're going to take Bill Gates's money. We're going to take George Soros's money away, Michael Bloomberg's money away. And we're just going to confiscate anything over $100,000. If you did that, you would basically run the country for a year.
Yeah, not even quite that much. I think it was Bill Whittle who did that, if you remember.
Bill Whittle.
He did the whole thing, and he said, okay, let's take everything all the NFL football players are making. Okay, we took that. He said, that gets us to April, you know, and he's showing you how far it gets, and he said, he finally gets to December 31st, and he says, yep, we've balanced the budget for 1 year. We haven't paid the debt. Just balance it. He says, unfortunately, we just wrecked the United States economy. You know? So when you see it in real world numbers, then you realize what we're truly dealing with.
Yeah. And let's take where the tax system is today. The top income tax rate is 39.6%, but that's not a true rate, because if you make over 125, or I think it's 125, 128,000, you pay additional Medicare tax of 2.9, and it's 3.8 if you make over a couple hundred thousand dollars if you're single, and I think it's over 300,000 if you're married. So add 3.8 to 39.6. Also, if you make over 200,000 single, over 300, you start losing your exemptions and you lose part of your itemized deductions. They take 3% of your adjusted gross income, whatever that figure is, and they subtract it from your itemized deductions. That increases the tax rate another 1%. So the top tax rate for individuals in that category that are making over $180,000 a year, the marginal tax rate goes up to 44.4%. And it gets worse, because if you're someone like myself that lives in California, the top income tax rate here in California is 13.3. And that's why Phil Mickelson was politically incorrect. But after one of his big golf matches where he won a lot of money, he was talking about, gosh, I need to move out of this state, because basically he's paying 57.7%. Between 44.4 on the federal level, 13.3 on California. And you remember how the media treated him, like, oh gosh, you know, you ungrateful person. You know, you don't want to pay 58% income taxes. The problem is, you raise taxes high enough, the rich stop investing. They stop taking risks. They stop building factories. They stop building buildings. And John, this happened very much in the 30s and 40s with wealthy people. Joe Kennedy hid out his money in tax-free bonds for pretty much the Great Depression. And then when things recovered, he went into and bought the Chicago Mart, where he sheltered most of his income. But the top tax rate was 90 to 94%. And you remember, John, back in the old days of Hollywood, when the actors were tied to a studio and they were on contract to make X amount of films. Well, beginning in the 30s, in the 40s, they only made one film a year, because anything over 100,000 was taxed at either 90 and eventually 94%. It didn't make any sense to work. Why would you want to work if the government takes 90% of what you make, which is what Bernie Sanders wanted to do? He said, you know, let's raise the tax rates to 90%. Do you really think people are going to work if you confiscate 90%? You take 90% of what they make, take another 13% from federal, and then you have the government taking everything that they make. And do you really think the government is going to invest that money efficiently? So what we've seen, John, as a result of these higher tax rates, is something we've been talking about in this economic recovery that has puzzled economists. Businesses and individuals have stopped investing. Non-residential investment has been declining for three consecutive quarters. And now you're talking about raising tax rates another 10% or even higher. You know, it just, there's something wrong when you work and you work hard and the government takes home more than what you make. And the idea And depending on what your political philosophy is, well, you know, the rich don't need this because they don't need the money, because they'll just invest it. Well, what do you think makes an economy grow? It's when investments are made. It's when, you know, somebody like Zuckerberg starts Facebook and creates hundreds of thousands of jobs, or Steve Jobs starts Apple. It's when people take those kind of risks that the economy grows, and we make create jobs, and that creates tax revenues, and the economy grows. It doesn't grow when you confiscate somebody. I have not, at least in recorded history, have yet to find a country in reading the history books that has taxed its way to prosperity. Most of the time, they collapse. And you're pretty much seeing that happen today in Venezuela's economy.
Well, let's go to the economy, stupid, because that tends to be what makes or breaks elections. Since the beginning of the year, it's been real obvious that the economy is slowing down. The leading economic indicators are not looking that good. And there is the risk that this economy and the way it's running is exactly why people aren't feeling too good about the way everything goes. Although it's hard to gauge that, because where there's some delirium in the market right now, so to speak, you know, some optimism, it may not be out in the general public.
No, and you're absolutely hearing zip about this in the political election. Now, Donald Trump is saying, hey, I'm going to make America great again. But I'm really surprised he hasn't hammered on some of the economic numbers. If I was his advisor, I'd be telling him, boy, I'd be really focusing like a laser beam on what's happening with these economic numbers. I mean, we already saw in the latest update, in the latest numbers for GDP in the second quarter, the economy, instead of growing at 2.6%, only grew at 1.2% in the first quarter. Was revised lower to 0.8%. So basically, in the first half of this year, we're growing at 1%. And more importantly, we've been trending down since the peak of economic growth in any particular quarter was in the third quarter of 2014. And the peak in the economy itself was in the second quarter in 2015. And we've been trending lower ever since that. And John, nobody's talking about this. It's just, you know, the financial markets are pretty much sanguine about everything. About, I guess, you know, the financial markets are always happy when stocks are going up, but they're not going up because of corporate earnings, and they're not going up because of economic growth.
You know, we've been covering a lot of this on the program here. And if you see 1 month where the data come out, they're not looking exactly too great, or a report, you know, people see reports and then that affects how people approach the markets. It's not too big a deal. But when month after month and quarter after quarter, they're all singing from the same hymn book, so to speak, there is a trend here and you need to pay attention to it.
Yeah. And it's one of the things that we've been highlighting over the last couple of months, because it's one of the reasons we've taken a more cautious approach to the markets last fall. And when you see one trend, as you mentioned, okay, that's one trend, that's one thing, so you keep an eye on it. But when you start seeing a number of trends start to coalesce in the same direction, then you pay closer attention. And one of the things that we've talked about is we've had four quarters of GDP decline in a row. We have had five quarters of inventory liquidation. That's not good, folks. When businesses are drawing down their inventory, they're saying, you know what, we're not manufacturing a whole bunch of stuff because we can't even sell the stuff we have in our warehouses. So they're drawing down their inventory levels. So we've had five quarters of inventory liquidation. On the job front, you know, the job creation is down about 50,000 jobs a month. Now, remember, a lot of these numbers that we get on a monthly basis are seasonally adjusted. Like, for example, last month we created 255,000 hypothetical jobs. The actual number was we lost 1.2 million jobs. So job creation is in a decline. If you take a look at corporate profits, why that's important: when corporations make money, they're more likely to spend money updating plant and equipment, build new factories, do all kinds of things. We've seen five quarters of consecutive profit decline. And I would say if we get into the sixth quarter here soon at the end of September, it's likely to be the sixth quarter of profit decline. Consumer spending, making up about 70% of the U.S. economy, is consumption. Consumer spending, retail sales are down. Restaurant sales, a harbinger of what consumers are thinking, are down 3 out of the last 6 months. And more importantly, fixed non-residential investment is down 3 quarters in a row. And as John, like, I could use the analogy of medical, you're going in, And your senior doctor, he says, oh my goodness, you've gained weight, your cholesterol has climbed, your triglycerides have gone up, your blood pressure is up. We may have a medical problem here. Well, if you take a look at these trends, we may have an economic problem here. And the thing about it is, this economic expansion, normally when you come out of a recession, the first couple of years you grow between 4%, 5%, and 6%. The economy is gearing up. Credit is flowing into the economy. And you average about 3% economic growth, which has been the post-World War II recovery average rate. This economic expansion, the average rate of growth has been 2.1%, probably the worst economic recovery since the end of World War II. And if you look at all the things that are happening in the economy, the poverty rate has gone up, food stamps have doubled, and nobody is talking about these things. Instead, they're talking about, you know, gee, the job numbers. Well, guess what? The participation rate has dropped, and it's one of the reasons the unemployment numbers have come down. My friend, economist Gary Schilling, in his recent newsletter, talked about the true rate of unemployment today in this country is probably closer to 11%. Then it is closer to 5%. So this is something that is alarming. And what really amazes me, and one should think about and reflect, the Fed has kept interest rates at zero for close to 7 years. We're now at 0.5%. And there's a number of individuals, and I would include myself in that group, that think that the Fed may not be able to raise interest rates. And wouldn't that be something? It's taken 2.5 years for the Fed to raise interest rates only 0.25 point, and then their next move might be to lower them again, just like the Bank of England got up to 0.5%, and recently they just had to lower interest rates by 0.25%, announce another quantitative easing program, and this time they're running out of a lot of sovereigns. They're going into the corporate bond market, and they're having trouble buying corporate bonds because a lot of people are saying, you know what, I don't want to sell you my 3% and 4% bond, because if I do, I'm going to have to invest it in a bond that is going to be so much lower in interest, if not negative. So I'm not selling you my bond, which raises the question, if we get into another bear market, another economic recession, what tools will the Fed use other than maybe a helicopter drop and more QE and maybe negative interest rates at the bank as it is at the institutional level? So, John, the economy is not where it should be. It should be front page news, talked about in an election, because that's what elections are for. You know, it's a chance for the public to say, who can better manage the economy? Well, these are the stats, and they do not look good.
And now we get into geopolitical risk, because things are rapidly changing around the world. Either the Soviet Union moving materiel towards Ukraine, or Turkey dissolving into a dictatorship. And of course, that involves NATO. And there are more things going on. But we also have China arming itself to do various things. At the very same time, it seems like the preparedness of our own military is in question. I don't know if you saw, Jim, the naval study that came out after those two riverine patrol boats were seized by the Iranian National Guard in January of this year. The media were absolutely silent, as far as I can tell, about what this report contained, because it showed nothing but incompetence on the part of the crews.
Well, it's not only that, but what I think is making this era that we are entering into is, for the first time, the U.S. is actually facing existential risks that didn't exist in the last financial crisis. And like it or not, the media will not talk about it. We are now in a state of war. It's not the kind of war like the Gulf War, or it's not like World War II, the Vietnam War, where armies line up on battlefields. It's more guerrilla war. It's the war on terror. And whether we want to admit it or not, Islamic Jihad is against the West. They have declared war on us, and we just don't want to talk about it. And it reminds me, John, you know, growing up, if you always watch the evening news, if you saw a terrorist attack, a bombing, it was always something that took place in the Middle East, mainly Israel, or somewhere in that region of the world where you had a lot of political instability. But what has happened now is that war on terror has moved into Western countries. And we're seeing in the U.S. and Europe, we're on Europe, there's a terrorist attack on average every 72 hours of some form or another. And there is a rush by the media to hush these stories and not let get it out. I have friends in Europe, and, you know, I had a friend recently visiting from Europe, and the stuff that he was telling me that was going on there is just absolutely amazing. And it's one of the reasons why you're seeing these movements that you're seeing in various parts of the different countries that are saying, you know what, we don't like what's happening here, and we're feeling vulnerable and at risk.
And Jim, it's not just about the war on terror, because this is, first of all, something like what we have dealt with at large in the West. But there is a larger geopolitical complex. There's always this changing chessboard of the Middle East, but also China and Russia. We had two stories coming out of the Wall Street Journal on Friday about China building naval bases, especially trying to build these bases on atolls and things, which you can barely call an island in the South China Sea, trying to make the South China Sea a Chinese lake, much to the discomfiture, by the way, of other countries such as the Philippines and Vietnam and Japan. And then we see more movement in the area of Ukraine on the part of Russia. You know, we know that Putin is coming up on his own day of crisis with Russia, and typically what people do economically, by the way, what people do when they get into their problems, they like to start wars because it diverts everybody's attention.
Yeah, the articles that you were mentioning in the Wall Street Journal, the headline was China builds its first overseas military outpost. Now, they've been moving and building air bases in the islands in the South China Sea. But this is a military base that they're building in East Africa, and they're working on building military bases around the Middle East. In Pakistan, they're talking about also Oman. And these are military outposts where they're moving military equipment in. They're building air bases. They're building seaports where they can expand their navy. And China is going through a rapid military buildup, and it's making very aggressive moves to the consternation of many neighbors in the South China Seas. And the problem with China is they have a huge debt problem. Their national debt went from $8 trillion to $28 trillion since 2008. And they also have a demographic problem. So they're building these naval bases and military bases. At the time, John, we are contracting our military. I don't care if it's the amount of ships in the Navy, if it's the amount of planes in the Air Force, or it's the amount of troops in the Army and Marines. And we're contracting and making the same mistake that Chamberlain made in England during the 30s as Hitler was going through a buildup in Germany. But it's not just China. If you take a look at another story that came out on Friday, once again, is Russia is now amassing troops on the Ukrainian border and bringing in missiles. And so we saw Russia invade Ukraine in 2014. Now, as of this Friday, it's been reported that they're amassing missiles and troops on the border. And also, they're for the first time in almost three or four decades, Russia is now establishing air bases in Iran with a partnership with Iran. They're flying a lot of their bombers and their attack planes out of Iran, very much as the U.S. has always used Turkey in its air bases for military purposes. And they're also building large bases in Syria. And so here are two major superpowers, China, the second largest economy, Russia, probably the second most deadly military in the world next to the U.S. They're amassing these troops, and Russia is rearming its nuclear forces. They're rebuilding their navy, and they're going through an arms buildup that we're seeing with major superpowers, and we're disarming at the same time.
Well, what's clear is that, say, if we, for example, if we look at Iran, their nuclear missile program is going on pretty much unabated. What they can't do, the North Koreans are doing for them. And the so-called treaty, which it really wasn't because it didn't have to be ratified by the Senate, it was an agreement that what we've been promised out of that is turning out to be false. At the same time, Iran is moving its influence into Iraq with a large number of troops there. You're watching, everything is radically changing. It all cut loose after the Arab Spring cut loose. And now we're seeing constant ongoing change. And of course, you know, if that were a little pocket of the world, people might say, well, that's over there and it's not good. But I guess if they want to fight it out, that's fine. But this is an area where we get our energy from right now. And that affects everybody then.
Yeah, and this is really alarming because, as you mentioned earlier, Turkey is now moving towards a theocratic dictatorship. In Libya, you've got vast portions of the state controlled by ISIS. And there was a report done on the military. It was a special on one of the news channels when they talked about, I live in San Diego, which is home to 40% of our carrier battle groups. We have 10 carrier battle groups. Four of them are based out of San Diego. We also have a submarine base here. We've got the largest Navy SEAL base. We have a Marine air station. We also have a Marine training camp here. And John, when a carrier battle group goes out, it comes back into port and it goes through modernization. You know, they update the software, the defense systems. And there was a story here in the local news how the Navy has been cannibalizing its planes because they don't have all the parts and equipment for it. So you want a carrier battle group to go out with planes that actually function and work. And what they're doing is they're robbing parts and supplies from one jet to keep another jet flying. And, you know, I saw this in the late 90s. I had an employee that worked for me whose husband was in the Navy, and I got to go on several Navy ships. I spent a whole day below on a nuclear submarine that was out of cruise missiles. They had none. They didn't even have the money for requisition on a new computer. It was amazing. This was, I think it was 1998 or 99. And watching in the control tower room, these guys, they used computers for fathometers, and they were using this outdated computer. And I remember talking to one of the specialists. And I said, why don't you guys get a Pentium? I'm surprised, you know, here I was on a billion-dollar warship, and they didn't have the money for a modern computer. They were using an old computer. It still worked, but still. And this is one of the things that we're starting to see now. We're cannibalizing our parts for parts. I don't care if it's tanks, planes, and even ships. And we're disarming ourselves at a time the world is becoming more dangerous. And that is something the next president is going to face. And you got to have a strong military. And when a military or a great power like the United States retreats from its role of leadership, there's a power vacuum and other players step in. And you go to a multipolar world, which a lot of people think, oh, gee, that's good. You know, take a look at what you're starting to see today. You're starting to see more political conflict.
Let's look at Obamacare. This was one of those things the politicos shoved through, and we all remember that fierce debate that I think they announced it in, what, May, wasn't it? And said we were going to get it done by the August recess. And everybody literally came bolt upright and said, what? And then we all tried to figure out what's in this bill as we went. And there was the usual heckling and screaming and shouting, much of which gets disgusting at a certain point because you can't get straight answers. But we all sort of knew that the program from its inception was going to implode upon itself. More and more of the major carriers are pulling out. Aetna and United Healthcare have done that. They're losing millions of dollars in these exchanges. And of course, if you remember back in the minds of the people who believed in single healthcare system, they viewed this as a step to get to a single payer system by imploding what you have already. And that's what it's doing. And then they can come back and say, golly, gee, golly, Willikers is just not working. We need, you know, and then pose themselves as the answer to the problem that they created.
Well, there's a number of issues here. And one of the bigger issues is it is going to implode. You have more and more of the insurance companies that are pulling out because they're losing hundreds of millions of dollars. The major players, United Healthcare is pulling out. Now you've got Aetna that's pulling out. And then in order to sustain this system next year, if you make over $85,000 and you're on Medicare, you are going to see your Medicare premiums go up by 23%. And then in 2018, everybody's Medicare premiums are going up. Because it's unsustainable. Going back to what I had mentioned in a topic we covered earlier that's not being covered is how much of a percentage of the government's budget is made up of entitlements. And so you look at these things, and the whole idea was to postpone this until after the 2017 election. Watch what happens to your medical premiums next year if you're in the private sector, and also what happens if you are one of those fortunate individuals that make $85,000 a year or more and you're on Medicare. Watch what happens to your Medicare premiums. They're going to go up substantially. And so, you know, what we wanted to do today is cover a number of issues because none of this stuff is being covered in the news. I only saw the thing about Russia and Chinese air bases. The only media outlet that covered that was the Wall Street Journal. They were on the front page of today's paper. But John, you looked elsewhere, you didn't see it covered. You know, CNN paid little attention to it. The major networks paid little attention. The Washington Post, New York Times, nobody was paying attention to it other than the Wall Street Journal highlighting it. The Wall Street Journal did a 9-page article on what China's doing and a 4-page article on what Russia's doing with amassing their troops on the border with missiles. And this is just why, unfortunately, John, we've gotten to a situation today in the media where you have a corrupt and dishonest media. And maybe we'll just end and talk about it because you've been in the media longer than I have. But John, I got a full bore education in media doing television news from 1991 to 1992. And that was really the genesis of Financial Sense because I would go to the television station. I had access to some incredible databases when it came for news because when you try to put your stories together at night, you had all this news, you had film footage, and I would print out these articles. And then I wouldn't see these articles anywhere. I didn't see it on the evening news. Remember, this was before the internet. So back in 91, you watched the evening news if you want to find out what happened in the world. Today, news is instantaneous. But I saw the way a lot of news was buried, a lot of news was covered, and I saw firsthand how we would take a story, like if we were interviewing somebody local back then, we were in the SNL crisis, and one of the local SNLs, Home Federal, went under, and I would see how we would take something out of context and bias the news. But John, maybe you ought to talk about another way that news is biased, is the omission of information.
Yeah, it's they report some stories and not report others. They report some facts and not report others and then hammer away on things. And so, you know, understanding that in the 70s and 80s, if you went to the broadcast or journalism colleges around the country, I graduated from them long before that, but they began to shift the emphasis from reporting the news to being social activists by how they shape the news to determine people's thought patterns and move them in a given direction. So nowadays, you're not getting news. I mean, you have to filter it through always asking the question, what's going on here? And, you know, some on the left might say, well, that's what Fox News is doing. Well, let me tell you, CNN was doing it long before Fox was ever doing it. The difference was before the alternative media sprang up in the 1990s, you had no way of evaluating that, you know. And it was only because of alternative media that suddenly stories were being kept alive that the gatekeepers couldn't keep gated anymore. So that's just where it is today. Well, that concludes our regularly scheduled program for this weekend. As we always do at the end of summer, we take 2 weeks off and put special programs up. And then back in September, we'll be back up with our normal weekly programs. Jim, what is it we have scheduled? Anyway, we're doing some interesting things.
Yeah, we're going to be doing some interviews coming up the following week. I'll be interviewing Michael Lewitt. He's a hedge fund manager. He's written a book called The Committee to Destroy the World Inside the Plot to Unleash a Super Crash on the Global Economy. That'll be coming up in the last week. And then right around Labor Day, I will have an in-depth interview with A. Gary Schilling. He's editor of Insight Newsletter and author of The Age of Deleveraging Investment Strategies for a Decade of Slow Growth and Deflation. That's coming up. And then we're also going to do, John, an in-depth On the Record. We haven't done that in probably a couple months. So a lot of fresh stuff coming up in the next couple of weeks. And of course, we will be back in September, right after Labor Day. It'll be interesting. The big boys will be back from their summer holidays in the Hamptons. We'll see what the market has to say and what they assess. And of course, John, this is when the markets really start paying a lot of attention as we head into the fall. We have the first presidential debates in September. I think they're going to do 3, and everybody's going to be watching the polls. But, you know, there's just something, I don't know what it is, John, about the polls, that sometimes these polls aren't as accurate as they used to be. And the best example was Brexit, where they thought Britain would vote to remain. Instead, they voted to exit. So who knows? Anyway, we'll have a lot to talk about. We'll also be looking at the economy. In the month of September, we'll end third quarter profits, which we expect to decline. So it could be 6 quarters of declining corporate profits. And of course, we're watching closely those economic numbers as we head into the fall. And of course, the markets as well. In the meantime, on behalf of John Loeffler and myself, we'd like to thank you for joining us here on the Financial Sense News Hour. Until you and I talk again, we hope you have a pleasant weekend.
You can subscribe to Financial Sense NewsHour in the iTunes and BlackBerry podcast libraries or at feeds.feedburner.com/FSM. Find more information about our guests at www.financialsense.com/newshour. Friend us at www.facebook.com/financialsenseonline. For our on-the-go listeners, you can access Financial Sense on your mobile device at m.financialsense.com. The Financial Sense News Hour is for informational and educational purposes only and should not be considered as a solicitation or offer to purchase or sell any securities. The investments, investment strategies, and investment philosophies discussed or presented on the News Hour each involve their own unique risk factors, which are not discussed on the show. Responses to listener inquiries are based on the personal opinions of James Poplava and do not take into account listeners' suitability, objectives, or risk tolerance. Financial Sense NewsHour and its parent company shall not be liable for any financial losses that result from investing in any companies profiled on or advertising with Financial Sense, or arising out of the use of any material on the NewsHour. Be advised that you invest at your own risk.